Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Mark Smith, president of the California Healthcare Foundation, underwriter of tonight's program. Find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org and the foundation at chcf.org. It's now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Margaret A. Hamburg, who was sworn in on May 22, 2009, to become the 21st Commissioner of Food and Drugs. The Food and Drug Administration was created as a result of the Food and Drug Act of 1906. Its initial concerns, which grew out of the muckraking exposés of the early 20th century, were with adulterated meat and other food products, poisonous patent medicines, and misleading labeling. For this reason, its early years gave rise to such cases as the rather colorfully named United States versus 40 barrels and 20 kegs of Coca-Cola. Today, the FDA is one of the most important and visible agencies of the federal government, protecting the public health by assuring the safety, effectiveness, and security of human and veterinary drugs, vaccines and other biological products, medical devices, our nation's food supply, cosmetics, dietary supplements, products that give off radiation, and as if that weren't enough, now tobacco as well. It regulates more than $1 trillion worth of consumer goods, about 25% of consumer expenditures in the United States, and over 30% of all imports to the country. No wonder, then, that it faces numerous areas of controversy and challenge and lawsuits as it tries to balance scientific innovation, economic interest, and protection of the public's health. Dr. Hamburg is supremely well prepared to take on this daunting task, having previously served as Commissioner of the New York City Department of Health and later as Assistant Secretary for Policy and Evaluation in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in the Clinton administration. Since 2001, Dr. Hamburg has helped lead the Nuclear Threat Initiative, where she served first as Vice President for Biological Programs and then as the initiative's senior scientist. We're particularly fortunate tonight to have another distinguished physician as our moderator for the evening, Dr. J. Michael Bishop, professor and director of the G.W. Hooper Foundation at UCSF. Dr. Bishop is a distinguished immunologist and microbiologist, winner of the Nobel Prize in 1989 and the National Medal of Science in 2003. Dr. Bishop recently stepped down as chancellor of the University of California, San Francisco, where he served with distinction for 10 years. On a personal note, I have known Peggy Hamburg since, as they say, back in the day, in the early 1990s when both of us were deeply involved in HIV issues, and I've been a big fan ever since. It is gratifying as a colleague and reassuring as a citizen and taxpayer to know that at least sometimes the really tough and important jobs are filled by really talented and capable people. Without further ado, please join me in welcoming Margaret A. Hamburg.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. I really appreciate your gracious introduction, and I'm really delighted to be here. I'm also very pleased that some representatives from our FDA regional office here in the Bay Area have been able to join us here today. You know, as I was preparing to come for this session, I learned a little bit about the Commonwealth Club and was very impressed to learn that it is, in fact, the oldest public affairs society in America, and that in a strange way, it actually shares some connection with the FDA. Mark sort of previewed the fact that if you go back to our roots, you'll see that both of our institutions are children of the progressive era. 1906, the year of the great San Francisco earthquake, was the year that, in fact, the first Federal Food and Drug Agency was created, and that was about 3 years after the Commonwealth Club was begun, as I understand it. At that time, San Francisco was the leading West Coast port, an entryway for new people, foods, and germs. And Teddy Roosevelt, who signed the Pure Food and Drug Act, which established the agency that would go on to become the FDA, was also the first in a virtually unbroken chain of U.S. presidents, as I understand it, to address the Commonwealth Club. So we are connected. But we, as the FDA, have come a very long way since those early days with Teddy Roosevelt with respect to our ability to safeguard our nation's supply of food and medical products. But when it comes to certain issues, such as import safety, which is the topic that I've chosen to speak about this evening, our approach is only starting to keep up with the changes that have swept the world since then. So, as we enter the 21st century, and more need to look at the world through a Pacific lens, I'm delighted to be here in San Francisco and honored to have this chance to address this special institution on a very important and timely topic. As Mark indicated, the scope of FDA's mission is tremendous. The products we oversee account for almost 25% of 25 cents of every dollar spent by American consumers. They include many of the foods we eat, the medicines, vaccines, and medical devices on which we may rely, and numerous other products that are integral to all of our lives every day. It's already a daunting task that we must take on, but globalization has multiplied the scale of our responsibility and the challenges that we face. FDA-regulated products are currently imported from more than 150 countries around the world, with over 130,000 importers of record and more than 300,000 foreign facilities that are producing goods that come into this country. This year, nearly 20 million shipments of food, devices, drugs, and cosmetics will arrive at U.S. ports of entry. Just a decade ago, that number was closer to 6 million. 20 million today, 6 million a decade ago. And before that, it was just a fraction of the 6 million. So we're seeing the numbers grow in startling ways. It's estimated that up to 20% of all foods now consumed in the U.S. originate outside our borders, and about 75% of the seafood we eat comes from foreign waters, and about 35% of fresh fruit and produce comes from other countries. And that's particularly worth noting because those are some of the food products that are most vulnerable to contamination with the highest risk. Up to 40% of the drugs Americans take are imported, and about 80% of the active pharmaceutical ingredients that are contained in those drugs comes from foreign sources. And frankly, I was just startled when I heard that number. And I found it almost as surprising to learn that 75% of the aspirin that we take here in America actually comes from China. So we can understand that the rise of imports has brought clear benefits to the American people. For example, we can eat all types of delicious products from around the world. We can enjoy a huge variety of fruits and vegetables that are way out of season because we're importing them. We can benefit from medical innovation that occurs across the globe, and we can get certain products far more cheaply than we might have otherwise without importation. Yet this tremendous shift in the global market for food and medical products has also brought important and often difficult new challenges. In addition to the sheer volume of imports and foreign facilities, there's been an increase in the variety and complexity of imported products and a large expansion in the number of countries involved in producing these products, including many with less sophisticated regulatory systems than our own. Simultaneously, the supply chain from manufacturer to consumer has become more and more complex, involving a web of repackagers and redistributors, making oversight significantly more difficult. And so this all adds up for an enormous task for the FDA. We know that there are very real concerns here. For example, in early 2007, melamine-containing products were manufactured in China and made their way into the United States in pet foods and animal feed products. You probably remember reading about this. It caused illness and death among household pets and serious illness in livestock across the country. The incident also had major economic consequences, including the recall of hundreds of brands of pet foods and state quarantines or voluntary holds on livestock that had consumed suspect feed. Soon after the melamine incident, the highly poisonous industrial chemical diethylene glycol, or DEG, was found in toothpaste imported from China. Thankfully, FDA was able to issue import alerts and support the voluntary recall of the contaminated products before they brought harm to U.S. consumers. However, other countries were not so lucky. DEG-contaminated products have led to scores of deaths elsewhere in the last several years. And the year before last, you may recall the tragedy that occurred when contaminated heparin, a blood-thinning drug, came from China and caused deaths and hundreds of allergic reactions here at home. These episodes were particularly disturbing because they represented economically motivated adulteration, truly despicable acts, seeking profit and putting lives at risk. We see this also in the worldwide market for counterfeit drugs. And sadly, in our modern times, it's not only the dark motive of profit that we have to grapple with, but we also know that we're very vulnerable to potential attacks on our food and drug supply by potential terrorists determined to do harm. So while these kinds of cases and potential scenarios are the most dramatic, we also must note that there have been other significant and perhaps less intentional episodes associated with contaminated and adulterated imported foods, both food products and, I should say, drugs and medical devices. And every day, FDA rejects imports at the border for a range of problems, including illegal drug residues, bacterial contamination, unapproved food additives, pesticides, heavy metals, and just plain filth. Every problem with an imported food or medical product is serious in its own way. There are human costs, economic costs, and often an undermining of trust and confidence in government and other critical institutions and in these products themselves. So together, these incidents reflect a new reality. Globalization has fundamentally altered the markets for food and medical products, and FDA needs to change in order to keep up. Back in the days when Teddy Roosevelt created the agency that would become the FDA more than a century ago, imports were not particularly significant. Americans grew most of their food themselves or purchased it from nearby sources. The pharmaceutical and medical device industries were in their infancy. Import safety was hardly a front burner issue, but Congress did authorize FDA to examine an imported food or drug when it arrived at a port. That, in most cases, was something like cracking open the lid on a barrel and looking to see if there was any mold or some visible sign of contamination on the food product inside. In the late 1930s, another Roosevelt administration in Congress reworked our nation's food and drug laws to create the modern FDA. In this process, the only provision from the 1906 Act that was carried over with very little change was the one covering imports. Because there had been so little change in the volume and nature of what was being imported into the United States that it was felt that the authority remained adequate to protect consumers. Today, however, the world has changed dramatically, and this approach is no longer adequate to meet our needs. It's easy to see that in today's world, FDA, in fact, faces a Sisyphean task if inspections at ports of entry remain our main strategy for identifying and stopping harmful products. In fiscal year 2009, approximately 18 million shipments of FDA-regulated products came to our borders, but we had fewer than 500 inspectors to ensure their safety. No matter how hard these employees work, no matter how dedicated they are, they will examine less than 1% of these products before entry into the United States. It is simply not possible to count on interdicting everything harmful at our borders. Similarly, FDA cannot alone conduct a sufficient number of inspections at foreign manufacturing facilities to help ensure product safety. The Government Accountability Office estimates that FDA inspects only about 8% of foreign drug manufacturing establishments each year. At this rate, it would take us more than 13 years to inspect all registered foreign drug facilities. So it is simply not possible for FDA to inspect our way to safety. Clearly, our nation's traditional approach, relying on FDA inspections to catch problems at the border or in foreign facilities, needs a significant makeover. To assure the safety of imported products and fulfill our public health mission in a global age, the FDA must adopt a modern approach, an approach that will address product safety by preventing problems at every point along the supply chain, from the raw ingredients through production and distribution all the way to U.S. consumers. We must move from an approach based on reacting to problems to one that proactively prevents problems from ever occurring. And this idea is embodied in the food safety legislation now moving through Congress, which would, for the first time, allow FDA to establish basic preventive controls over food production. This modernizing of our basic authorities is critical to our success as a public health agency in the 21st century. And we must apply this principle of prevention to all imports. FDA is starting to make this shift. And I'd like to share three key elements of our strategy. First, we're seeking better controls at the point of production. This is a shared responsibility among manufacturers who have the primary responsibility for the quality and safety of their products, national regulatory agencies, which we're supporting through collaboration and with technical assistance, and the global regulatory community, which must come together as never before. We're moving into a phase at FDA where we work with regulators, manufacturers, and suppliers in places as far afield as Bangladesh and Tunisia. We now have permanent overseas offices in Beijing, Shanghai, and Guangzhou, China, in New Delhi and Mumbai, India, in San Jose, Costa Rica, Mexico City, and Santiago, Chile, and we'll soon have an office in Amman, Jordan. These offices enable us to have a regional presence around the world and a home base from which to undertake a range of important activities. We're working with these countries and others to help assure oversight and regulatory capacity. By helping more countries build their regulatory capacity, we not only build confidence in the imports they send us and they send to others, we're also helping them build regulatory powers that will improve the safety and value of goods their own people consume. There's also much work to be done with our allies who already have well-developed regulatory systems. For example, FDA and our partners in the European Union and Australia are jointly planning and conducting inspections of facilities and countries that manufacture the starting materials for many of our drugs. FDA has more than 30 additional agreements with foreign counterpart agencies to share inspection reports and other non-public information that can help us make better decisions about the safety of foreign products. This means, for example, that if a shipment of fish contaminated with banned fungicides shows up in, say, some part of Italy, we'll hear about it immediately and be on the lookout for products from the same shipper. We've set up offices in London, Belgium, and in Parma, which is the center of the Italian food processing industry, to build on these relationships. We're also piloting the concept of third-party inspection, which can stretch our resources and provide new assurances of safety. And we continue to engage in bilateral and multilateral international standards development and harmonization efforts. These programs are promising, and all of them make one thing clear. To address import safety, we cannot go it alone. A second key element of our strategy is to hold importing companies responsible for their supply chain. Some companies already do a terrific job in keeping tabs on where and how their products are made and the path taken to reach our shores. These best practices need to spread around the industry, and FDA will work with the industry to set standards for technologies and other approaches that can help them strengthen their supply chains. On the other hand, companies that sell contaminated products because of loose supply chain oversight need to face serious penalties and cannot excuse themselves by blaming their suppliers, blaming the FDA, or blaming anyone else. Only when everyone involved shares responsibility for safety will we succeed in our mission. Third, we're going to deploy our agency's resources strategically. This is essential as our mandate keeps expanding, and sadly, our resources are not keeping pace. And even though President Obama, from the very first day when he announced my appointment, also signaled his commitment to strengthening the FDA in many ways, and especially in the realm of food safety, these are very economically challenging times. Early next month, I expect to formally announce a new FDA program that was actually initially piloted here in San Francisco, which is an information technology system called PREDICT, developed for use by our border inspection operations, that will allow us to monitor products at the port of entry more reliably and to prioritize shipments that potentially pose the greatest risk to public health. This is the kind of example of using our resources in a more informed and efficient way, but this is just one step. More broadly, we're moving from a system that places most of the regulatory burden on the FDA's modest inspection force to one that creates greater oversight at points further back along the production chain. To succeed, we will need more resources, such as those that are provided in the food safety bill that we're hoping will eventually be passed in Congress, and we'll need to be very smart about what we do with them. We also need, of course, to take a very serious, concerted look at drug and medical device import safety and our needs there. We need to know who is making our food and drugs, where they are located, and we need to be sure that these facilities are being inspected and are accountable for what goes into their products as well as for the products they produce. We need to create a global safety net. I can assure you that addressing the problem of global supply chain safety and shifting the existing paradigm from reaction to prevention is one of my highest priorities for the FDA. Refining our understanding of the problem and exploring and assessing possible solutions will be a major focus of our work this upcoming year and well into the future. Ironically, 70 years ago, DEG, the same poisonous chemical found just a few years ago in the tainted Chinese toothpaste I mentioned, precipitated another similarly significant shift in the FDA's approach to product safety. In 1937, 105 people in the United States died after ingesting elixir sulfanilamide, an antimicrobial medication that included DEG as an ingredient. In response to this tragedy, Congress passed the 1938 Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. As a result, FDA moved beyond simply responding to problems and intercepting adulterated drugs on the market. We began to conduct pre-market evaluations to prevent unsafe drugs from entering the market in the first place. The most recent DEG episodes show that we need another fundamental change. We need to change the way we do business, and this time we need to do it on a global scale. This will require new ways of thinking and new partnerships, in addition to new resources. Now is the time for FDA to fully engage bilaterally, multilaterally, and through international and regional organizations, to work with countries throughout the world, to share scientific and technical expertise, to harmonize international standards for safe food, drug, and medical products, and very importantly, to help countries with less mature economies and regulatory systems build capacity so that they can produce food and commodities that are safe, wholesome, and meet international safety standards for both their own consumption and for export. The benefit of this new paradigm for global product safety goes well beyond our borders and, in fact, goes well beyond health. When governments collaborate to invest in the capacity of countries to produce food, drugs, medical devices, and cosmetics for export in accordance with strong safety standards, there are multiple and mutual benefits. The developing countries can have both a domestic source of safe products and strong, reliable export markets. Strengthening their regulatory capacity will help them extend their health protection activities as well as their own economic growth and development in very fundamental ways that will have long-standing benefits for those nations. And what's great about this all is that at the end of the day, all of us will be healthier. All of us will be safer. Although my duty as FDA commissioner is to protect the health of the American people, and importantly, the safety of our nation's supply of food and medical products, my experience throughout my career has shown me time and again that public health protection is a global endeavor. All people in the world deserve safe food and access to quality medical care. All nations deserve the opportunity to participate and to prosper in the global economy. We, as an agency, have difficult work ahead of us, but this is a challenge that we're eager to meet. And going forward, I firmly believe that we need to marshal the talents and engage the creative thinking of determined citizens, scientists, government officials, political and business leaders, thought leaders, in short, so many of you in this room today, to work with us in this task, because this is truly a global vulnerability and truly a global responsibility. Thank you very much.
We have quite a few questions, and they are broad-ranging, Dr. Hamburg. Let's start with a topical matter, the budget. President Obama just announced a budget freeze on non-security discretionary spending. Do you think that this jeopardizes food security? Is food security included in the agencies that will not be part of the freeze? And what about the CFSAN and FSIS? I'm sure you know what those acronyms mean. Will they share the same fate? And while you're at it, would you build into that a comment on whether you're concerned about terrorist attacks on the nation's food and drug supply?
All right.
What's being done to thwart such plans? In essence, do we have a security problem with what the budget might do to the FDA?
Well, with respect to the budget, you know, I think that adequate funding for the FDA is a very important issue, and the sad truth is that over many, many years, decades, regardless of who's in the White House and what political party has control of Congress, FDA has simply been underappreciated and under-resourced. And we know that neglecting the needs of FDA comes at the peril of all of us. FDA is a very unique and important institution. It's a science-based regulatory agency with the mission to protect the health of the public, to promote the health of the public. We are responsible, as you've heard, for overseeing products that comprise about 25% of what consumers spend in this country, and we oversee products that Americans use and count on every single day, from the time they get up in the morning to the time they go to bed. If we cannot do our job and do it well, there is simply no other agency of government, no other private sector entity. There aren't brilliant professors innovative entrepreneurs who can step in and backstop behind us. America is counting on the FDA, and I think and hope that our political leaders will have the foresight to support us in our budget needs. I am concerned, and I have to be realistic, that these are very difficult and challenging economic times, and we are not going to get all the resources that we want and need. But I believe that in several critical areas, we will continue to see some increase in our budget, and I think food safety will be one. The President has made his commitment to food safety very clear, and last year gave us a historic increase in our budget for food safety. I'm not expecting to see that again, but I know that we will continue to get resources that we need as we move forward, and this food safety legislation that I mentioned is very, very important, and we're hoping that there will be funding embedded through actually industry user fees to help support the budget requirements. Because another important point is that really to be able to do our job and do it well, we need sustained and predictable funding. And we've had a unfortunate history of sort of ups and downs. There's a particular crisis, an outbreak of disease, or a recognition of a potential vulnerability, and we'll get an increase, but then a year will pass and other competing priorities will emerge and our budget will again go down. So we can't build the kinds of programs we need operating in that way. With respect to the freeze, I honestly don't know what the parameters are, and I'm waiting anxiously to learn more about both when it would be implemented and what areas it would cover in terms of our own arenas. With respect to the threat of terrorism and do I think that we are vulnerable, I think, you know, the honest answer is yes, we are vulnerable. And I've worked a lot on issues of terrorism and biological threats, so I take it very seriously and have thought very deeply about it. I think that there are ways that we can continue to shore up the points of vulnerability in our food system, but it is a vast system and very, very hard to really secure in many important dimensions. But the good news is that what we need to do to protect the safety of our food supply against naturally occurring threats to it, contamination that occurs in terms of just issues of handling and exposure, and some of the concerns around intentional adulteration, either motivated by profit or other reasons. Those things that we need to do will also create much more of a safety net against the threat of biological terrorism. So I think we need to think very carefully about our vulnerabilities in terms of that extreme threat, but we also need to move swiftly to put in place the basic safeguards to make our nation's food supply safer.
Dr. Hemberg, if a citizen wants to make the case for FDA's funding, where should they direct their comments? Are there key people in Congress, for example, that you would be willing to identify for us?
Well, you know,
for example,
Congress is, of course, you know, a wonderful place to turn when thinking about matters of resources and appropriations. You know, FDA sits in a particularly strange situation with respect to our budget, because we actually, unlike the rest of the department to which we belong, the Department of Health and Human Services, we have our appropriations done through the Agriculture Committee. And we have our champions on that committee, and the chairs on the Senate side and the House side are both very, very supportive of FDA, Senator Cole and Congresswoman DeLauro. And I must say that as I went around doing visits as part of my confirmation process, and as I've settled into my role as FDA commissioner and spent time on the Hill, in both houses and in across the aisle in terms of Democrats and Republicans, I've been really, really gratified by the level of support for the FDA, the recognition that everybody benefits when we have a strong, functioning FDA, and the fact that FDA has not received the kind of support over many years that it truly needs to do its job. So I'm guardedly optimistic, but all support is welcome.
Okay, let's turn to another very newsworthy item. Recent news reports regarding horrendous errors in radiation therapy. And this questioner also mentions infusion needles, but I think the radiation therapy examples are particularly egregious. These raise concerns about the operational safety of products regulated by the FDA. It seems that both matters are of longstanding, the questioner says. Does the FDA not have a mandate to investigate such matters earlier? I suppose, more importantly, does the FDA regulate the use of medical devices by practitioners?
Well, you know, this is an important concern, and I think this is actually an area where the FDA has been very proactive. In fact, the FDA, responding to a couple of initial reports of adverse events associated with radiation exposure, this was actually in CT scans, then prompted us to reach out and actually sort of survey other healthcare institutions to look to see if, in fact, there were similar problems going on but that weren't being reported to us. And sure enough, we found that the problem was more widespread. And we're moving forward, you know, on two important fronts in order to address it. One is education. To inform the users of these pieces of equipment about the nature of the problem and how to guard against it and what kinds of checks and double checks to be used in order to make sure that the machines are being used appropriately, but also working with the manufacturers to say that this is unacceptable and that the devices need to build in safeguards to prevent inadvertent overexposure. And we are developing a major initiative in this arena that I think, you know, will be very important for protecting consumers and will actually result in significant change in the types and approaches that manufacturers are taking to these products. So, you know, I think it's an example where FDA could simply sort of track what's going on in a much more passive way, but where we actually stepped up to the plate, helped to identify the problem, helped to define the nature and scope of it, and have begun important actions to remediate it.
But do you actually have any oversight authority for the practitioner using the device?
Well, we don't regulate the practice of medicine, but we feel we do have an appropriate responsibility to help ensure safe use, whether it's safe and appropriate use of medications that we regulate or of medical devices.
All right. I'm going to turn to a question that has a couple of suppositions buried in it, and you might find it interesting to comment on those. The questioner apparently has just finished a year on a Fulbright in Germany and says that I have observed that drug and healthcare costs there are significantly lower due to restrictions on health insurance companies and much faster approvals of new drugs. How does the FDA plan to work with this administration to take examples from Europe while still ensuring drug safety?
Well, I have heard, more than once that if you compare various European countries and the U.S., that we are consistently slower. And actually, that isn't true. The data doesn't support that. In certain instances, we have taken more time. In certain instances, we haven't approved a drug that's been approved either by the European Union or by another nation. And in some instances, it's the other way around. But there's actually a lot of comparability. But I think to build on the question, in this globalized era, as I was talking about earlier, I think it's very appropriately that we work increasingly closely with our sister regulatory agencies and that we share information, we share strategies. There's a lot to learn from how different regulatory authorities are approaching the review and potential action on a drug or a medical product. And I think, from the perspective of both what consumers need and what industry needs, the more we can begin to harmonize standards and approaches, the better off everybody is. So, I think you'll be seeing, greater engagement across different regulatory authorities. And I think this will have particular value also as we really start to grapple with some emerging technologies where we're really, breaking new ground in terms of what are the appropriate standards for review and how do you assess comparabilities of biosimilars? How do you develop standards for stem cell products? How do you evaluate the chronic safety concerns of nanotechnology? I mean, I think that there are a lot of areas where, both in terms of the science and in terms of the regulatory process, the more we can work together, the better off we'll all be.
For the benefit of our radio audience, let me just say that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Margaret Hamburg, who's Commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. And Dr. Hamburg is discussing how the FDA is keeping food and medicine, devices, and other medical matters safe for us. I want to turn to an issue that's not represented in any of the questions that came up, science at the FDA. Mm-hmm. I think it's widely believed in the informed public, and this may or be, and may not be correct, that that the scientific staff at the FDA is not sufficiently large and might even need more talent, a higher level of talent. You've had a year now to size that up. It would be interesting to hear your thoughts about it. Obviously, science is a crucial part of the FDA's role. Regulatory science is a huge intellectual challenge and a great public importance. What are your thoughts about the staff at this point? We'll take it from there.
Well, I'm very delighted to get this question because it's an aspect of FDA activity about which I care very deeply. And I think that it's very, very important to recognize that FDA does need strengthening of its science base. We need to be able to attract and retain the best and the brightest minds in science today. We need to have state-of-the-art facilities to do some of our important scientific work. We need to have more quality scientists because the volume and demands on these individuals are increasing rapidly. And it is a truth that right now it's inadequate. There have been numerous studies, reports, commissions that have noted these concerns. I actually haven't been on the job for a year yet. It's only 8 months, but who's counting?
I rounded it off.
But believe me, I knew on day one that this was a huge area of concern. I would have to say that we have an extraordinary cadre of scientists at the FDA, and remarkable work is done every day, and the contributions really are staggering. But these are challenging jobs, and we need more resources and support for our scientists. But as I've really looked at it, I've recognized that I can't be too narrow in my perspective if I really want to serve the FDA and the needs of our nation appropriately, that strengthening science within FDA walls is a critical challenge and a high priority. But we also need to actually build a much more vibrant and robust field of regulatory science for our nation. I think it's really not recognized that as you think about the scientific enterprise, there is a continuum of types of science that you need to be able to translate discoveries into real-world products for people who need them. And that we have invested very appropriately and generously in biomedical research. But we have totally allowed regulatory science to atrophy. And I sometimes use the image of a rower, since I frequently find myself driving along the Potomac River in the wee hours of the morning, and the various teams are out there. But, you know, it's like we have, I think, in our nation, a rower that has one, you know, really quite well-muscled arm, and that's our biomedical research activities. But the other arm is really, really scrawny. And if you think about it that way, it's no surprise that sometimes we're going around in circles. We're not seeing some of those opportunities in science and research translating into the products that we hope for and that we need. And the reason is because we're going around in circles and we need to be making forward progress. So I would turn to you as a leader in the field of science and say, will you work with me to really help build a robust and highly credible field of regulatory science? Because I think that it is an area of research that demands, you know, the true collaboration and partnership across sectors, academe, industry, and government. There's a whole research agenda that is yet to be fully developed. There is a need to really build the knowledge and the tools so that we can effectively and efficiently assess new products for their safety, efficacy, potency, quality, performance. And if we really, I think, address this arena, we will not only see a much, much more effective ability to really leverage all of the excitement and advance in science and technology today, but I think we also will help to support important sectors of our economy, to support our global economic competitiveness, and I think that we will also be able to make much more significant contributions to addressing unmet public health needs because we will have a more effective and efficient regulatory process. So I think, you know, your question is most welcome, but I think if we're really going to make progress, we need to do it together.
I would agree with that, and I think one starting point is to proselytize amongst the latest generation of young scientists. What we've seen in the last decade is an increasing number of newly minted PhDs with interest in alternative careers. Patent law, venture capital, journalism. But regulatory science is not on their radar screen. And I think that's partly because they don't read newspapers, and partly the fault of their faculty who are talking to them about alternative careers, but it never occurs to them to talk about regulatory science, which is really an extremely interesting and challenging field. And let me just say that I know several of the senior scientists at the FDA, and I have a great respect for them.
I was going to say, you know, triggered, you know, by what you were saying just then, was that you know, regulatory science, I think, you know, is sort of viewed as just what a bunch of bureaucrats do to sort of, you know, be able to sort of check some boxes and do their paperwork, but that it's not an exciting field of science. But I think when you really look at some of the challenges today, genomics and the prospects for personalized medicine, regenerative therapies, nanotechnology, you know, some of what is really exciting in cutting-edge science really is also regulatory science. And for people that, you know, really want to be doing science to make a difference in people's lives, well, regulatory science sits at the gateway to making those products available. And so, you know, I have a vision that perhaps everything costs money. I keep coming back to money, I'm afraid. But, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if FDA actually could have the resources to help set up centers of excellence at some of our best research universities, where we could have cross-disciplinary and cross-sector efforts to address important issues in regulatory science?
Well, okay. Let's turn then to another interesting problem in, I guess, oversight. What is the FDA doing to increase monitoring of adverse drug effects after drugs are marketed? And, of course, Vioxx is the example par excellence.
Well, we're in the midst of a major push to strengthen our post-marketing drug safety activities. And it's taking a number of different forms, and I think, you know, that it's a very important aspect of some new thinking, you know, where instead of just thinking about our role in terms of up to the time of approval or disapproval, we're really thinking, again, about the life cycle of the product. And we know that even with the best clinical trials as part of the approval process, you don't often know everything you need to know about safety. In fact, you never really can know what you need to know about safety until it's actually out there in communities being used, not by, you know, thousands of patients, a couple thousands of patients, but by millions of patients. So it's a very important focus. As I've discovered at FDA, much of what we do is also linked to laws and authorities. And in the post-market arena, that's very, very true. In 2007, the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, what does it stand for? Amendments Act, FDAAA. It's fondly called FDA, actually gave FDA significant new authorities in the post-market arena. It includes strengthening post-marketing surveillance so that we can get a much broader and more timely assessment of emerging safety signals using information technology and data mining techniques in order to get those early warning signals that can then be investigated and followed up on. It also gives us the authority to require certain targeted clinical studies that will go on to answer certain questions about safety and risk, even with the approval of the drug. Also, additional authorities around warning labels. We are increasingly using strategies in certain instances to provide additional information to patients at the pharmacy when they receive certain drugs, or certain restrictions on only certain pharmacies can actually make certain drugs available, so that it's done with more oversight, and in some instances certain requirements for who can actually receive a drug under what circumstances if there's a high level of risk. So it's a much more nuanced, sometimes much more complex set of activities that are very, very important, because it does give us more confidence as a drug that may have a certain set of real-world risks, but huge benefits for patients who need them. We can feel more comfortable moving those out into the marketplace and into the community if we know that we have mechanisms to be able both to continue to track safety concerns and also to increasingly target the appropriate use of the medication for the people who will benefit from those drugs.
Well, what are the current penalties, if any, for companies that sell tainted or unsafe food or drugs? Do you have, or does the federal government have, what kind of punitive resorts do you have?
Well, there are a number of different strategies that can be employed, and of course, moving towards ensuring safety often involves a bit of a carrot and a stick. We want to be clear about the expectations. We want to work with companies to make sure that the food products they are selling or the medical products that they're producing are safe. But when there are problems, we clearly have a responsibility to act. To be honest, we don't always have all of the authorities that we would like. And I've mentioned now a couple of times the food safety legislation, which we're very much hoping will pass, which would give us some of the authorities we need to actually mandate recalls of products. Right now, in many instances, we have to work within the broader legal system to be able to prevent certain products from going out into the marketplace if companies won't voluntarily recall. You know, thankfully, most companies, when a problem emerges and when we sit down with them and try to both clarify the nature of the problem and articulate our concerns, are responsive and do what needs to be done. But when they don't, we need to be able to act, and we need to be able to act swiftly. And it's an arena where I think we have been perhaps more aggressive of late, because it is enforcement is a very important component of our overall strategy of protecting the health of the American public.
Well, speaking of authority, let's talk about tobacco. What is the nature of your authority now, the FDA's authority to regulate tobacco? How much teeth does it have? How do you envision it being implemented, and where might it lead?
Well, this is, of course, a very historic event that FDA does now have the authority to regulate tobacco products. In June of this year, President Obama signed into law this authority, and FDA moved swiftly to start establishing a center for tobacco products. The law contained a lot of requirements and mandates for action, and we've begun to implement. It enables us to take certain actions with respect to marketing practices, with respect to labeling, and with respect to the composition of tobacco products and how those products are manufactured. So it's it's really a multidimensional challenge where we have to draw on a very strong base of science, some of which already exists and some of it we still need to build. And it's both, the basic scientific understanding of tobacco and tobacco products. And for the first time, we're going to be able to actually require from tobacco companies to provide us with information about what is in those products so that we can understand it and we can address the serious health concerns. But also behavioral research to better understand about what kinds of warning labels actually make a difference in helping to reduce smoking. And an important thrust of the law is really targeting youth smoking and what can be done in order to prevent youth from taking up smoking, because we know that if you start smoking younger, you're more likely to smoke for life and all of the attendant health risks there. So, for example, we've already banned flavored cigarettes. It's remarkable what was out there. I had no idea. But that, I think, you know, is one example where I think our regulatory actions will really make a difference, because some of these products were clearly being designed to seduce young smokers into taking up the habit.
Another issue of authority, and that would be television commercials for prescription drugs. What authority, if any, do you have over the content of those advertisements?
Well, we do have regulatory authority over aspects of the content in terms of the messages that are conveyed and the accuracy of the information. It's an arena where there's obviously a lot of controversy about what is the role of advertising direct to consumers. And we're actually, as I understand it, one of only two countries in the world that actually allowed direct to consumer advertising for prescription drugs. I would hope going forward that we may have more opportunities to work with companies, not just to monitor the content of the ads and the accuracy of the claims, but also to help encourage that if they're going to do these ads, to provide more information about the disease conditions that will actually be of benefit to consumers in a broader educational sense. And I would tell you that as I'm just beginning to learn more about some of these issues, the challenge of the internet is probably the greatest of all in terms of all of the information that's out there and how can you really monitor it and the primacy of that as an information resource for so many people, and it can be very, very positive. Of course, all the depth of information on the internet, but advertising on the internet is really a thorny issue.
We have time for just one more question. Here it is. It's in, I think, a lighter vein. It's three parts. What is your favorite food? What is one food you'd never touch, and why? And what is one thing the average consumer can do to avoid problematic foods, toxic foods?
It's easy for me to say what is my least favorite food, although it's a category of food, and I hope I won't get in trouble for it later, but I really don't like Ethiopian food. I keep trying. I keep thinking I would like it, but I just don't. Favorite food, you know, I like almost all food. You know, the issue of nutrition and you know, sensible eating is a complex one. And it's hard even as a, you know, fairly informed, educated person to even track all of the different studies, you know, that one week say, you know, eat this and the next week say don't eat that, et cetera. But I think there are certain My mother used to always tell me, and sometimes mother's advice is the best, she had two related dictums around food. One was everything in moderation, and the other was rotate your poisons. But I probably shouldn't say that in my official role. and I know this isn't off the record. But I will say in a more serious vein that that nutrition is an area of FDA activity that we take very seriously. And I think we made a huge contribution about 15 years ago when the FDA spearheaded the nutrition facts panel on the back of processed food packages. And we're now starting to look very seriously at front-of-package labeling. When you go to the grocery store, you've probably noticed that there are all kinds of different symbols and messages on the front of the package. Well, we would like to work with industry to move towards a more universal system, but we think that consumers really do want to get easy access to important nutrition information, and we want to help make that possible.
Well, our thanks to Commissioner Hamburg of the FDA. We also thank you and the audience here and our radio audience for your attention. We like to acknowledge that the program has been generously underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. I'm Michael Bishop, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.